Deep in the Amazon, today on The World. The Amazon used to absorb greenhouse gases. Now it may be emitting them. And that's bad news for the climate and for all of us.
The Amazon was buying you some time that it's not going to buy anymore.
We traveled to Brazil to investigate the causes and consequences. Plus, inside California prisons, inmates have been segregating themselves along ethnic and racial lines.
You come in already designated Southern Hispanics, there's Northern Hispanics, and then if you're Mexican national, it's by state. What state you are in Mexico or what country you're from in Central America.
But the rules in the yard are changing. I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and more coming up right here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. It's good to have you along with us. We start today with the biggest story of our time, probably the biggest for generations to come, the health and future of our planet's climate. This week, we're looking at one very important part of that story, the Amazon rainforest. I feel like I've been hearing about the Amazon and protecting it for decades. Spin back to the 1980s. Remember when Sting and his wife Trudy Styler got a personal appeal from Chief Rayoni of Brazil's indigenous Kayapo people to help protect their community, their land, their trees? Rock for the Rainforest had a bunch of shows over the years at Carnegie Hall that raised funds for the cause. Other artists got involved with the Amazon on separate paths, like keyboardist Merle Saunders and Jerry Garcia of the Grateful Dead. They released an album, Blues for the Rainforest. That was in 1990. The Save the Amazon fervor seems to have grown quieter since then. But now in 2018, the fate of the forest is still a major concern. And now it's about all of us and the changing climate of the whole planet. Reporter Sam Eaton kicks off our stories this week.
When I was a kid, my parents gave me a big book about the Amazon. The inside cover had an aerial photo of a jungle and a river that split and curved, so it looks like a stick figure of a man carved into the forest. I was 8, and I was mesmerized. But reading the book's bleak warnings on deforestation, I wondered if I would ever get the chance to visit the place before humans destroyed it. Now, nearly 40 years later, I'm with a group of Brazilian scientists in a still pristine patch of forest in the central Amazon north of Manaus. We unload boxes of heavy instruments from a truck and disappear down a thin path into the trees. I'm instantly soaked from the humidity. Half a century ago, the Amazon covered an area about the size of the lower 48 United States. Since then, more than 16% of that has fallen to loggers, miners, and land grabbers. Direct human impacts like these have long defined the battle to save the rainforest. But Carlos Quesada with Brazil's National Institute for Amazonian Research says a new threat is now looming.
The forest is responding to the atmosphere.
And the atmosphere is changing. Chainsaws and cattle are still eating away at the forest's perimeter, but carbon dioxide coming out of tailpipes and smokestacks thousands of miles away is altering tropical forests on a much larger scale.
So in areas completely remote, far away from people's influence, the forest is changing.
Forests just like this one. Quesada and his colleagues take me farther into the forest to show me how. The first research plot we reached looks almost like an emergency room for the forest. Every tree is laden with wires and sensors, instruments, brightly colored nylon ribbon, identifying and measuring everything from photosynthesis and evapotranspiration rates to tree growth. We climb up a 130-foot tower toward the canopy. Halfway up, research assistant Giuliani Menezes sets up a key piece of equipment.
This equipment is a portable photosynthesis system, which is attached to leaves like that. We open this chamber and put it inside of here.
A leaf still attached to the tree glows red inside the chamber as the machine pumps higher concentrations of CO2 onto its surface.
And then we take the measurement and download all of these measurements of the day to model the photosynthesis.
Plants use photosynthesis to turn CO2 or carbon dioxide into food. And there's a lot more of it in the atmosphere these days. Over the last 200 years, humans have pushed CO2 levels higher than they've been in almost a million years. This experiment is basically tracking, at a micro level, what that means for the world's tropical forests. On the one hand, Quesada says, all of this extra CO2 is what's causing global warming.
But on the other side, high CO2 can stimulate growth.
Growth in trees like these. And for years, that's what's been happening. The Amazon and many other forests have been absorbing a lot of that extra CO2 and converting it into leaves, branches, and trunks, essentially capturing and storing pollution that would otherwise heat up the atmosphere even more. Quesada says until recently, the Amazon was hungrily absorbing the equivalent of the CO2 pollution from every car on the planet every year. But even a huge forest like this one can only capture so much more CO2 before it reaches other biological limits. And Quesada says the Amazon appears to have done that and stopped sucking up extra CO2.
So we are changing the atmosphere. The atmosphere is changing the climate system. The climate system and the level of CO2 will change how the forests behave.
In fact, a few years back, for the first time on record, it actually released more carbon than it absorbed. It flipped from what's known as a carbon sink to a source of carbon.
It's probably said, no, okay, it's enough. Now you guys stop.
Laughing aside, Quesada says this scenario is actually quite terrifying.
If the Amazon, which is the biggest tropical forest in the world, stops taking this extra carbon, doing this environmental service of sequestrating carbon from the atmosphere, the idea is that it will all accumulate in the atmosphere. And CO2 will show a greater increment than it has been showing so far.
In other words, he says, when it comes to climate change,
the Amazon was buying you some time that it's not going to buy anymore.
And Quesada says that's just here, in pristine forest. In Brazil's so-called arc of deforestation along the southern and eastern edge of the forest that marks the advance of logging and agriculture, the impacts are much greater.
So you have already a fragile system that may be on the edge, and then you bring on fragmentation, deforestation, cattle ranching, illegal logging. So you imagine on top of this, a future climate that is drier and hotter. Okay, so this could really be a tipping point in the future of the Amazon.
A tipping point for the Amazon's ability to absorb that extra carbon from the atmosphere, and maybe for the Amazon itself. There's growing evidence that the entire forest ecosystem could be on the verge of collapse, and that could lead to a runaway climate change scenario.
It's very serious.
Carlos Nobre is Brazil's leading climatologist.
We are dangerously approaching irreversibility.
Nobre and his colleague Thomas Lovejoy of George Mason University have determined that the combined effects of deforestation, fires, hotter, drier temperatures, and increased CO2 in the atmosphere are pushing the Amazon system to the brink. He says if deforestation continues at its current pace, more than half of the Amazon could begin to die off, releasing massive new amounts of carbon into the atmosphere.
So, not to take the risk of exceeding some of these tipping points, we advocate that deforestation should not exceed 25%.
That 25% threshold doesn't leave a lot of wiggle room. And by many accounts, deforestation here is still rising, even accelerating. But Nobre says it's crucial to put on the brakes if we're going to meet the Paris Climate Agreement's target of limiting global warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius to avoid the worst effects of climate change.
If we want to pursue the Paris Agreement limit to warming, we are going to live in a world in which emissions will have really to be net zero all over the planet, because the carbon sinks will decline over time. It's a very different world in the future.
At Carlos Quesada's Amazon research plot, he says this is the time when science matters more than ever. But Brazil has been struggling through an economic crisis, and the budget of the entire National Institute for Amazonian Research has been cut by almost half.
We don't have the funds guaranteed to do this research.
Quesada is hoping to install circles of giant towers around patches of forest here and then blow a constant stream of higher CO2 concentrations over the trees to mimic future conditions. He says understanding how these forests will react to high CO2 is critical to predicting the Amazon's impact on climate change, good or bad.
Yeah, it's like a glimpse of what the atmosphere will be in 50, 100 years from now. To understand if we still have forest later on or not.
Knowing this now could give Brazil and all of us time to plan ahead and adjust our way of life. Quesada says building those towers here and running experiments over the years would cost somewhere in the range of $15 million, a small investment that would answer arguably one of the biggest questions facing humanity. Can we save the Amazon so it can help save us? For the world, Sam Eaton, outside Manaus, Brazil.
The forests. I, for one, would like to keep them. Tomorrow, Sam visits with powerful landowners along the Amazon's arc of deforestation and with government officials fighting a losing battle against deforestation. Our series this week is a partnership with The Nation magazine and the PBS NewsHour, with support from the Pulitzer Center and the Society of Environmental Journalists. Sam also brought back some amazing photos and video. We've got a full digital spread at theworld.org/Amazon. You'll see a lot of forest if you fly over parts of lowland Guatemala, dense green forest as far as the eye can see. But what lies beneath? Archaeologists know the Mayan civilization once thrived here, but the extent of that domain was unknown until now. Scientists carried out an aerial survey using LIDAR, a kind of laser radar, to penetrate the forest canopy. The results are frankly astounding, and they were published last week in the journal Science. Thomas Garrison of Ithaca College in New York is one of those archaeologists. So the LIDAR images kind of resemble X-rays. They've got this kind of ghostly quality to them. When you look at those images, what do you actually see on the ground?
Yeah, so, you know, one of the big things that's been bandied about has been this over 60,000 new structures. And what that's referring to are these, what you see on the ground, we call them mounds. And they're the remains of the platforms of ancient Maya households. You know, it's showing us not just the kings and queens that lived among these palaces and pyramids, but the everyday population.
So those are the images. I know you've spent plenty of time on the ground in this part of the world. Describe this tropical forest of lowland Guatemala.
Yeah, you know, we sometimes refer to it as the green hell for those of us that do survey down there. You know, one of the things is that when you're down there on the ground looking for these subtle ruins, sometimes you can't see 10, 20 feet in front of you. One of the sites that we discovered using LIDAR around the area where I work is a Maya fortress. And I must have been within 100 feet of it in 2009 and didn't have any idea it was there. Wow. And so what LIDAR reveals are these, you know, long, subtle features, defensive works, road systems, things that even when you're standing on top of them on the ground, you don't notice because they go beyond your field of vision.
So break it down for us, Professor. What does this research do to our actual understanding of Mayan civilization?
Well, it's interesting. This is sort of like a baseline study that lets us know that we need to be reconsidering a lot of things about the ancient Maya. The real results of this are going to be now in 5 or 10 years as we now go onto the ground, because what you're looking at is over 2,000 years of Maya civilization compressed into these amazing images. So we need to now go there and figure out which cities were where when, how did this culture emerge and grow and eventually collapse. And so we know that there are a lot more people that were there. We know that they have a lot more sophisticated agriculture than perhaps we previously thought. And we know that the scale of their warfare is happening in a way that we hadn't really thought of before.
Thomas Garrison with Ithaca College, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
Coming up in Philadelphia, a collection of Mideast art and its guides from Iraq and Syria who will show you around. That's next here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're listening to The World. Headsets, interactive displays, splashy items in the gift shop. Museums do a lot to make their collections come alive for visitors. Here's something the University of Pennsylvania Museum of Archaeology and Anthropology is doing. It's launched special guided tours of its newly renovated Middle East Gallery, and the guides are local residents who come from Syria and Iraq. Reporter Emma Jacobs has a story from Philadelphia.
Let's move now and visit one of the rulers of our city.
Mumina Sardar directs a group of visitors to a glass case containing an enormous gold headdress and beaded shirt, the burial garments of one Queen Puabi, who died around 2550 BCE.
Puabi's burial jewelry is one of my favorite objects in the galleries.
In Syria today, she goes on to explain, people still save up for gold jewelry for their wedding day. She shows pictures of packed jewelry shops in Damascus, walls glittering from floor to ceiling. Sardar and her family came to Philadelphia as refugees in 2016. She now works as a medical interpreter and gives tours here on weekends. In Syria, her family lived outside Damascus.
We are so proud that it's the oldest continuously inhabited city in the world.
But even though very old buildings were woven into the city fabric, she didn't think about their age.
Oh my God, we are looking to it today.
After she was selected to become a guide, Sardar went through intensive training to prepare her to give detailed historical tours and respond to visitors' questions. She practiced on her five children.
Gathering my kids at home, pretending that they are my visitors, and if they have any comments, did they understand what I'm saying?
Kevin Schott, the Penn Museum's education programs manager, says Sardar and the other guides offer something local docents can't.
I do tours of the Egypt galleries and the China Gardens and several others. And at some point in almost every tour, someone will say, well, what about today? Do they still eat these foods today? Or is this place still a place people go? And like things like that. And I'm like, I don't know. I can't answer your question.
These guides can make connections to the present. They're trained to weave their own personal stories and memories into their tours, things that they would feel comfortable talking about over and over again.
Sometimes we used to take, like, you know, the soccer balls and play.
Another guide, Hadi Jazim, spent his summers as a child at his grandfather's house in southern Iraq. It was near the source of many of the objects in the gallery, the ruins of the ancient city of Ur.
Because it's an open area, sometimes we used to play, like, other games, like seek and hides and all this, you know, kids' games. But when I become older, I was visiting those sites and, like, sit there for hours just to think about, maybe I'm sitting on a spot. Somebody was sitting on that spot 6,000 years ago.
Fresh out of college at the beginning of the Iraq War, Jazim became an interpreter for U.S.-led coalition forces. Then he worked for the U.N. in Iraq, doing communications and anti-trafficking work. In 2017, he finally received permission to come to the U.S. on a visa for Iraqis who worked for the U.S. military. Now, Jazim has a job in food service at a local hospital. But the museum work is more than a second income.
Sometimes, even if I don't have tours here, I just show up to work, go through the gallery, and go and see the clay tablets and see the carving and all this. It's just like, bring my memories back.
Jazim and Sardar have been asked by visitors whether these antiquities belong in a Western museum. Sardar says she usually responds by talking about how the objects in the Penn Museum were excavated around a century ago under a shared agreement with local governments. And Jazim tells me this. He's very upset about the damage to Iraqi historic sites that happened during the war and then by ISIS and looters. It gives him some comfort, he says, that some of his heritage is being preserved here, and so nearby.
Being close to your heritage is something that makes you feel like, okay, now I'm back. I don't feel like I'm a stranger no more.
For The World, Emma Jacobs, Philadelphia.
If there's a few minutes to spare, there's always time for some of my favorite music, Afrobeat. Nigeria's Fela Kuti was its pioneer. I think he'd be pleased that in the wake of his death just over 20 years ago, a bunch of Fela-inspired Afrobeat bands seemed to materialize. The Brooklyn-based Underground System, for example. Here's the band's lead singer, Domenica Fossati.
Some of you Afrobeat lovers or Fela Kuti lovers might already notice that our name Underground System is based off of Fela's last album before he passed away called Underground System. And it was kind of an homage to him when the group started. We'll be right back. The music of Fela Kuti came into the sound of Underground System basically because my co-leader, Peter Madsen, who is actually the one who started the band, really loved Afrobeat, loved the music of Fela. And within 5 months, he saw me perform with another Afrobeat band that's led by the singer of Antibalas, Amayo. And he asked me, would you like to join us and just play a couple of songs on flute, maybe sing a Fela song? And I said, sure. And I really enjoyed it a lot. And I became more involved and started working with him as a co-director in partnership with the band. That girl, she's got some jokes. That man, he got some questions. He be fellas good to stop. One of the songs in the album that has a nice Afrobeat vibe is called What Are You, which is the title track of the album. The song is a pretty personal song for me, as well as for the band, but for me it's a question that is asked often because I'm multiracial, African-American, Italian, and I think a lot of people see an ethnic ambiguity, and so they don't know how to ask, what is your ethnicity, or where are you from? They ask, what are you? Which is a very strange question to hear. Who you be? Years progressed, Underground System started changing personnel and experimenting with different sounds. We kind of became more influenced with new wave, Italo disco vibes, and so combining everything that we've listened to living in New York City and the underground dance scene, we put everything together and kind of came up with the sound that we use with the album.
Domenica Fossati of the Afrobeat band Underground System telling us about their new album, What Are You? At theworld.org and on the radio, you're with the world. I'm Marco Werman. Canada's NAFTA negotiators tried something new. They found allies at almost every level of the U.S. government, creating a so-called donut around a White House-shaped hole. But maybe that analogy needs a tweak.
It's more like a Danish than a donut because the hole is filled as well.
Pastries. Trade. That's ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. What a difference a few days can make in U.S.-Canada relations. Last week, President Trump was talking about why he didn't want to have a one-on-one meeting with Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau to discuss trade.
Because his tariffs are too high and he doesn't seem to want to move, and I've told him, forget about it. And frankly, we're thinking about just taxing cars coming in from Canada. That's the mother load. That's the big one. We're very unhappy with the negotiations and the negotiating style of Canada.
Yesterday, with a new U.S.-Canada-Mexico trade deal in hand, that icy tone had melted.
I have to certainly give my highest regards to Prime Minister of Canada, Justin Trudeau. A lot of stories came out about Justin and I having difficulty together, and we did over the trade deal. But I'll tell you, it's turned out to be a very, very good deal for both and a very, very good deal for all three. It puts us in a position that we've never been in before.
So how did Trudeau and Canada win such praise from the White House? According to one report, the answer is Canada's donut strategy in its trade talks with the U.S. Former Trudeau advisor Roland Paris says the donut analogy is close, but not quite there.
The report that described it as a donut strategy suggested that the effort was to go around the White House and to build relationships with people in Congress, with state governors, with mayors, with, you know, people at all levels of the political system and with American industry. The reason the metaphor is wrong is that it's more like a Danish than a donut, because the hole is filled as well.
Gotcha.
Because part of the strategy was to build strong links with the administration, the White House itself, and that did take place.
Right, so maybe a cronut.
Yeah, there you go.
Whatever it's called. You said all levels of the U.S. political system, that included public and private. Who was enlisted in this project on the Canadian side?
Well, it was quite extraordinary on the Canadian side, and there was a degree of unity in the Canadian effort that we haven't seen before that reflected this sense of threat to our economic interests. But on the Canadian side, most obviously, you had provincial premiers, mayors of cities. You had a group of advisors pulled together from different political parties, and a kind of extraordinary display of solidarity among parties that are normally snipping at each other.
So this project even enlisted former Conservative Prime Minister Brian Mulroney, yeah?
Well, Mr. Mulroney, of course, was prime minister when the first Canada-U.S. free trade agreement was negotiated in the late 1980s. So he had a particular interest in this issue. But he also happens to have a place in Florida, very near Wilbur Ross. And he has a relationship with Donald Trump. And so he was one of the people that the current Canadian government reached out to. And as I said, he represented a different party than Mr. Trudeau's party.
Yeah. Do you know any specific details about the actual kind of access that Brian Mulroney got, because he has this social circuit in Florida with Wilbur Ross and Donald Trump?
He was at Mar-a-Lago one evening and was brought up and actually sang a song, as he's been known to do in the past, and chatted with Donald Trump, who was present. But, you know, other conversations were, of course, private.
So a former prime minister from Canada who's conservative going to bat for a current prime minister who's liberal, how rare is that sort of bipartisanship in Canada?
It's pretty unusual. Now, bear in mind that Mr. Mulroney had a particular interest in trying to salvage NAFTA, since he was a part of negotiating in the first place. But it's hard to overstate the extent to which Donald Trump's attitude towards NAFTA and towards Canada in general has galvanized Canadians. You know, this is a core economic interest for Canada. 75% of our exports go to the United States. It's about a fifth of our entire GDP. This is the one truly existential interest in our foreign policy. And I've seen a level of unity in the political class, which has frayed a little bit in the last few months, but certainly across the country, and support for the prime minister's efforts that I haven't seen before.
Canada didn't do this when Obama or Bush were president. Why'd they feel it had to do this now with Trump? Not just play the face-to-face with the Trump team, but also triangulate around him to get this new NAFTA sorted?
Well, the reason for this was quite simple, that our core economic interests were at stake, that even just the auto sector alone, there are 100,000 jobs and many, many, many more jobs that are dependent on that. And the idea of a 25% tariff on Canadian autos going to the United States, that sharpens the mind. But I do want to emphasize one thing, which is we're talking as though this thing is over. From the Canadian perspective, this is an ongoing challenge. We're dealing with a U.S. president who's mercurial and unpredictable. There are remaining issues to be resolved, including these steel and aluminum tariffs that are still in place.
Isn't there a safeguard if Trump tries to withdraw from the deal now?
The deal seems to be the deal at this point, and it's a matter of passing it through our respective ratification processes. But the steel and aluminum tariffs remain in place and were not lifted as a result of the deal and aren't part of the deal, and those remain important to Canada. And although one would hope that this will set a path for a more positive relationship between Canada, the United States, and Mexico, we can't afford not to take precautions. And anything can happen, as we've seen with this president. And part of taking precautions is saying this campaign is going to continue indefinitely.
Roland Paris, a former foreign policy advisor to Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau. Thanks very much for your time.
Thanks, Marco.
The new trade agreement with Mexico and Canada brings more certainty to the U.S. economy. That's a good thing. But here's something else to worry about. New estimates from the Congressional Budget Office show that our government's borrowing is off the charts by historical peacetime standards. According to the CBO, in just a few years, we'll be spending more money to pay the interest on our national debt than we will spend on our defense or Medicare. To put it another way, the U.S. has become one of the most indebted nations on Earth. We asked the world's Jason Margolis to help tell us what that actually means.
A few years ago, when the Republican Party didn't control all the reins of government, deficit hawks like Congressman Paul Ryan were constantly banging the drum about the perils of a rising U.S. debt. Here's Ryan speaking to CNN in 2012.
We have a debt crisis right in front of us, and what brings down great empires, past and future, is debt, and they're doing nothing to prevent it.
And here's Donald Trump speaking to CBS when he was running for president.
I will tell you, we are sitting on a time bomb, and Hillary Clinton doesn't have a clue. And President Obama has pretty much doubled the debt since he's been in office. And somebody's going to pay a big price. We have to start chopping that debt down.
But once Obama was out and Trump was in, Republicans were singing a different tune. Under Trump and Speaker Ryan, spending has gone up and the Republican tax cuts have blown a bigger hole in the budget. Today, the U.S. debt sits at $21 trillion. A huge, scary figure, but also kind of meaningless by itself.
Where the threshold is of too high, we don't know. But rising forever is definitely an unsustainable big problem. And we're the only advanced economy on an unsustainable course.
Economists like Jason Furman at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government study what's called the debt-to-GDP ratio, how much a country owes versus how much it generates.
All the other advanced economies, it's falling.
Germany, France, Mexico, Argentina, Mongolia, they're all carrying a smaller debt-to-GDP ratio than the U.S. If you look at a list of how we rank internationally, the U.S. is sandwiched between Bhutan and Jamaica. We're carrying our heaviest debt load since World War II. Economists say when you're in a time of recession, it's time to spend, to get the economy going again. When the economy is roaring along, as it is now, it's a good time to save, says Chris Edwards. He's the director of tax policy studies at the Cato Institute, a libertarian think tank in Washington.
The Republican Party used to be outside of the national defense area, sort of the party of spending restraint, but they no longer are. You don't hear anything about spending restraint from the major Republican leaders, and the fact that we're in the 10th year of an economic expansion now, and debt keeps rising is really extraordinary and very irresponsible. Unless Congress fundamentally changes its path, we are headed for a Greek-type crisis.
But what exactly could that mean?
The rising debt, could create this crisis situation where interest rates spike. The government has to take drastic actions, perhaps, cutting benefits, Social Security and other benefits radically, or hiking taxes dramatically, which will damage the economy.
Social unrest, people taking to the streets as their savings evaporate. Could that happen in the United States of America? Mark Goldwine doesn't see us as the next Greece, but he does think we should be paying more attention to the debt.
One of the scary things about debt is we probably won't know we're too deep in debt until it's too late.
Goldwine is a senior policy director with the nonpartisan think tank, the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget.
I don't think we're headed for a Greek-like crisis because, unlike Greece, we borrow in our own currency and we can actually make our own currency. But I do believe that our current path is unsustainable. And I do believe that if there isn't a course correction at some point, we will face a financial crisis. We will actually potentially create a global financial crisis.
That's not as bleak as a full-scale Greek crisis bordering on anarchy. Jason Furman at Harvard doesn't think either of those scenarios is likely. He served as chair of President Obama's Council of Economic Advisers and says the debt should have never been our number one issue in the first place.
But I don't think it should drop off the list of concerns entirely either.
When it comes to the United States debt right now, he says he subscribes to the termite in the woodwork theory.
That every year they chip away at your prosperity a little bit and leave you a little bit worse off, but without everything ever being really dramatic.
Still, after a while, your house will need to be fixed. And continually delaying repairs, we all know that's going to cost you. For the World, I'm Jason Margolis.
This year's Nobel Prize in Physics has been awarded to three scientists, Donna Strickland of Canada, Gerard Mourou of France, and Arthur Askin of the U.S., for their groundbreaking work in laser research. That work has led to innovations in different fields, including laser eye surgery. Donna Strickland is also the first woman to win the Physics Prize in 55 years. The last woman to be honored was Maria Gaepert-Meyer in 1963. That's something Strickland was thinking about today.
It's great that times are changing. You know, I cited Maria Gaepert-Meyer in my thesis, and I've read about her and realized that, you know, she didn't even get to be paid to be a scientist while she was doing Nobel-worthy research. And obviously, I've always been paid and treated like an equal throughout my career, so things have changed.
But there's still a long way to go, at least judging from what happened at CERN this week. CERN is the European Organization for Nuclear Research, and it's just suspended an Italian scientist for what it called a highly offensive presentation. During CERN's first-ever workshop on gender and careers in particle physics, Professor Alessandro Strumia said that physics was, quote, invented and built by men. He showed charts and graphs that he said indicated that men were the victims of discrimination in physics and frequently got passed over for jobs. Dr. Jess Wade is a physicist who was at the event and was shocked by what she heard. She voiced her concerns on social media, but says she's received a lot of hate online.
There's an awful lot of people in that audience and around the world who have a contract that is 3 years and then will go towards a selection committee that could have one of these kind of people on it. It could even have Professor Strumia on it. And I don't want the biases that he holds against women, apparently, to have an impact on their careers. And I suppose I'm very frightened now after a night of abuse from trolls that actually he could have an impact on mine.
Women who are now studying physics can relate. They're going into the field knowing that they'll be in the minority and not always welcome. We spoke with three women today who are in the physics program at the University of Massachusetts here in Boston. We asked them what they thought of today's Nobel news. Guy Coulter-DeWitt is a 19-year-old physics student, originally from California. She says she stands out when she attends talks and lectures.
When I walk in, I will generally be the only undergrad, which is scary in itself, and often the only woman or one of like two or three.
Another student we heard from is Charlotte Chamaya. She's from Ghana and studying medical physics imaging. She says that Professor Strickland's achievement today should be celebrated by women in her field.
By putting in much effort, it will help us to become who we want to be in the physics world so that we don't need to wait for another 55 years to win a Nobel Prize. And I think the problem is about women being a wife and a family, like, and a mother too. To me, in my opinion, I think it's best for women to marry physicists. At least they'll be in the same field and they'll help each other, and by that, they improve the number of women in this physics world.
Then there's Vida Karamnia from Iran. She's studying for a PhD in biophysics. She agrees that this is a momentous day.
It really matters, yeah. You should really pay attention to the work that the women do in the science. So it really matters that we recognize them.
And as DeWitt and Chamaya explain, no matter what the challenges are for women, studying physics is worth whatever obstacles they have to overcome.
I like working towards understanding the secrets of the universe, and I also really love how weird it gets, especially when you get really big and especially really small with quantum. You get some things that your intuition just completely breaks down, and I find like puzzling through that, through the language of math, just very exciting.
Physics is so beautiful because it tells you about the universe. Everything that happens on Earth is about physics.
Yeah, everything that happens on Earth is about physics. Congratulations to Donna Strickland and her fellow winners on their Nobel Prize today. The U.S. has the highest incarceration rate of any country on Earth, more than 700 people in jail per 100,000. Russia is second, and other nations after that aren't even close. And here's another reality about our prisons. Inmates of different racial, ethnic, and immigrant backgrounds rarely mix. But that is changing in places like San Quentin State Prison in California. Today, we're going to look at this from the point of view of one prisoner in San Quentin.
My name is Jesse Vasquez. I'm currently 35 years old. Been incarcerated for 18 years for attempted murder.
His family is Mexican-American, and he recently spoke with The World's Monica Campbell about his experiences.
Jesse Vasquez says one of his first lessons in racism was at a high-security prison in California near the Mexican border.
The prison is predominantly Mexican and Black. It's not just racially segregated, but it's gang segregated. And that's self-imposed. We do that to ourselves. I couldn't associate with Blacks, even if I wanted to, because of the rules and the structure. You know, we have to just keep them in their area and we stay in our lane.
He was 18 with multiple life sentences and navigating racial tensions like never before. Growing up in California, he says Mexican-American families like his socialized with people from all backgrounds.
I remember going to school with Blacks and whites and Asians. So, you know, we had everything.
He remembers celebrating the Vietnamese New Year, eating dinner at friends' houses, African-American families. In prison, he says, he had to know his place as someone with Mexican roots.
Being Mexican in prison sucks. Not only do you have to do your judicial sentence, but you also have to deal with the peer pressures of having to fit in. You come in already designated Southern Hispanics, there's Northern Hispanics, and then if you're Mexican national, it's by state. What state you are in Mexico or what country you're from in Central America.
He says he had to conform to survive.
The actual moment that, you know, kind of shocked me into it was when one of the older Mexican guys, one of my neighbors, were walking to chow and he had this, you know, handlebar mustache, you know, and it sounded like he was talking in the movies, you know, he had that Mexican accent, that stereotype, you know. And he says, you know what, homie, we don't talk to these negros. You know, we don't engage with them. We don't do business with them. And if you do, you're going to get in trouble. At least you're going to get beat up. At worst, you're going to get stabbed. I knew then that I was in a different world because of the consequences.
There were also standoffs among prisoners.
Where we had like these stare downs, right? Where it was like, get off my table type thing, right? And one particular incident that I remember, they had just brought this new picnic table onto the yard. And everybody wanted it because it was by the basketball court. The Blacks sat on it and they laid claim to it. And the Mexicans were like, hey, man, we want that table. They were literally willing to kill somebody for a damn table. I was, you know, mandated to actually get involved. So I couldn't actually think for myself.
Then, about 2 years ago, he was transferred to San Quentin, just across the Golden Gate Bridge. We meet inside, just past the gates.
Hey there.
How you doing?
Hi.
Jesse.
It's nice to meet you.
Likewise.
How's it going?
So far, so good. You know, it's nice breeze.
So we just arrived to what's called the yard.
This is the San Quentin Lower Yard, and the biggest thing that people that visit here look at is the fact that it's racially segregated.
It's true. Hundreds of men working out, hanging out, split along racial and ethnic lines. You see this in the cell blocks, too. Jesse shows me his cell.
So this is where I live?
Hey, Don Flaco, what's up?
His roommate is from Mexico.
Oscar.
Oscar?
Sí. Bienvenido. Gracias.
And this is where you sleep?
It's like a big person's closet. You know, bunk bed. And then you have a locker in the back right above the toilet and the sink. I can actually touch, you know, the wall and the bunk at the same time.
But San Quentin, today, is focusing more on rehabilitation and getting prisoners from different backgrounds to play sports together, work together. That was new for Jesse. For 15 years, he'd only socialized with prisoners with Mexican heritage.
I was like a fish out of water. I was uncomfortable because of the camaraderie that there was amongst the races. When I would walk the yard, it bothered me that Blacks, whites, and Mexicans were playing basketball together or that they were playing baseball. I was like, man, these guys are out of line.
He didn't know who to trust.
One of my first neighbors when I got here in West Block, he offered me a burrito one night, and I was hungry as hell. And it's a Black guy, and he's offering me a burrito. And I said, oh, no, I can't take this. Hell no, you know? I thought it was a setup, right? When I got back in the cell, you know, I started thinking, wow, you know, I'm really hungry. I stepped back out, and he looked at me, and he says, you know, it's not like that here. You know, I started thinking about that.
He started getting involved and found his place at a newspaper published here, the San Quentin News, one of the only prison newspapers in the country.
So this is the San Quentin Newsroom. This is where I spend most of my time, 7 days a week.
It's in an old warehouse-type building. Computers along one wall and, a bit surprising, a soap opera with subtitles on the TV.
It's Korean. We watch Korean soap operas. You know, that's one of our guilty sins, you know.
You guys watch Korean soap operas?
Yes, we do. We do. We watch Korean soap operas in the afternoons. One of the staff members actually lived in Korea, and then he was watching them one day, and then I started watching them, and now we have this soap opera club.
It's also where Jesse met the newspaper's editor-in-chief, who's black.
My name is Richard Richardson. People call me Bonnaroo. I'm 45 years old. I was born in East L.A. I've been incarcerated for 21 years.
Jesse started working with Bonnaroo, and at first, there was tension.
I find it's hard for inmates to accept orders from a different race, especially when you're coming from other institutions where we don't even communicate with other races.
Bonnaroo and Jesse are now really tight.
When I first met Jesse, did I think I was going to be that close to him? No, absolutely not, right? Because Jesse, he's kind of standoffish. You know, you don't know how to approach Jesse. You know, he got that stern look. I guess it's for all the years that he's been incarcerated. You know, however, since the time that I have known him, that brick wall has been coming down slowly but surely, and he smiles more, he plays more. Man, he even gave me a hug, tripped me out, right?
Jesse says he's been thinking a lot about his childhood, his mix of friends back then.
You know, I went away from my childhood, and I kind of slid too far. You know, I was just, like, stuck.
He has a wider group of friends now, and it's taking him out of his comfort zone.
Blacks, Asians, you know, whites, every Mexican, whether he's North, South, Bison, Mexican National, I've come to terms with the fact that, you know what, we all need help. We're on this journey, right? Because we're all in the same place. You know, I can't let the environment keep dictating who I am.
For the World, Monica Campbell, San Quentin, California.
Journalist Yukari Iwatani-Kane contributed to that story. Jesse Vasquez also shared his experiences in an op-ed published this week in the Washington Post. Look for a link on our Facebook page. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios here at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.